a better way. You don't have to be another
Hi, folks. Welcome to Friday Infusions. I am Jack Spierko, the host of the Survival Podcast, one of the longest-running podcasts available today. First launched in 2008. With almost 4,000 episodes published since launching, Friday Fusions is a blend of my input and the virtual AI hosts at Google's Gemini Notebook, formerly known as Notebook LM. That means that most of this episode will be done by the AI hosts. Now, if you want more of me, I still publish 4 episodes a week. These include my Monday Mayhem episodes every Monday, a Tuesday Just Jack type episode drilling into one specific subject, a Wednesday interview show, and a Thursday Expert Council show. All of these except the Expert Council shows are also available in video, and we do those as live stream episodes that you can tune into as well. For more on that, just visit my website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, or just search for The Survival Podcast on any podcast platform. Some things to know about the AI portion of this podcast. Sometimes, guys, AI makes mistakes or even hallucinates. I do try to make sure all the things in these podcasts are accurate, but please verify anything you act on before you act on it. Number 2, sometimes AI may pronounce something in a strange way or different from what is used in common language. Just know I publish full show notes at thesurvivalpodcast.com, and if there's like a list of things or plant types or anything like that, I will generally list them in the notes so that you can look them up and learn more about them and know exactly what they were talking about. Just go to the website and find the episode. If the episode's a bit old, by the time you listen to it, just use the website search feature and enter the episode number in the search box, and you should be able to find it very easily. The show notes, number 3, will also contain links to the source files I use to create the episodes. While I don't give away my exact prompts, I do provide the source files so you can use them to create your own podcasts, presentations, or even videos using AI as well. Number 4, you will hear the host at the beginning state what lens they're viewing the source material through. That is a direct result of my prompting and a great way to really unlock all of Notebook's potential. Just know once again, these are simply AI virtual voice entities, and these are assigned roles that I gave them, not reality. Now sit back and enjoy today's topic.
Imagine, if you will, an empire stretching like 4,000 kilometers across, you know, the most unforgiving, vertical, freezing terrain on Earth.
Oh, absolute brutal terrain.
Right. We are talking about jagged Andean peaks, impossibly thin air, and a landscape that just aggressively resists human habitation.
Yeah, it really does.
But at the height of its power, the people of the Inca Empire, they never went hungry. I mean, they had achieved something that should have been completely impossible.
It's incredible, honestly.
They domesticated as many plant species as all of Europe and Asia combined, but then the Spanish conquistadors arrive in the 16th century, and they just, like, looked right past this staggering agricultural wealth.
Yeah, they prized silver and gold and, I guess, the conversion of souls way over the profound botanical genius of the indigenous people.
Exactly. They basically instituted this botanical colonialism. They deliberately suppressed these ancient climate-resilient crops and replaced them with European staples like wheat and barley.
Which, you know, often failed miserably in those high altitudes. It really is one of the greatest botanical tragedies in human history.
It really is.
But as we're going to explore today in this deep dive, it also represents an immense future promise. We are essentially sitting on 10,000 years of indigenous selective breeding.
And modern agricultural science has just largely ignored it, right?
Totally ignored it. Yeah. And these aren't just quaint heritage plants. I mean, they're sophisticated genetic technologies just waiting in the wings.
Right. And before we start excavating these ancient terraces, we really need to establish where we're drawing this incredible information from.
Yes, definitely.
So this deep dive is heavily rooted in a landmark 1989 National Research Council publication. It's called Lost Crops of the Incas.
Such an important document.
It really blew the lid off this forgotten agricultural empire for the modern scientific community. And I want to emphasize that this conversation is just the first in a comprehensive series on the lost crops of the Incas.
Yeah, we've got a lot of ground to cover.
We do. And this series is published on Fridays as a special supplement to Jack Spirko's long-running show, The Survival Podcast. These Friday supplements are known as Friday Fusions.
Then they have a really unique format, right?
Yeah, exactly. What makes them unique is that they blend AI creation with human input. The human input comes directly from Jack, who uses highly specific prompting and publicly available documents, like that NRC report, to create the AI portion of the show.
It's just a brilliant way to process and explore this dense material.
Absolutely.
And, you know, coming at this as a botanist, my entire career is dedicated to looking at lost, marginalized, and undiscovered plants. I research exactly how they can provide food, fiber, medicine, and ecological resilience for human needs.
Which is exactly why you're here.
Right. And when I look at these Inca crops, I don't just see old food. I see literal genetic gold mines. And we're talking about millennia of forced adaptation to extreme environments.
Like drought and frost and all that.
It's exactly. Relentless UV radiation, impoverished soils. These plants are perfectly adapted to survive the exact climatic chaos that modern agriculture is currently terrifyingly vulnerable to.
Terrifyingly is the right word. And coming at this as a cultural anthropologist, I am just completely obsessed with the sheer logistical genius of Inca agricultural organization.
Oh, it's mind-blowing.
Right. I mean, they weren't just throwing seeds in the dirt. They managed millions of tiny terraced plots. They navigated incredibly complex microclimates by moving crops up and down the mountainsides.
And their storage systems were insane.
Yes. They engineered these thermodynamic storage systems that kept massive communities alive through multi-year droughts. I mean, they were freeze-drying foods centuries before the modern era.
It's astounding. The tragic loss of this cultural and ethnobotanical knowledge is just, it's hard to fathom.
It really is. So our mission today is to resurrect a piece of that for you, the listener. We are going to guide you through 9 specific incredible tuber crops.
9 heavy hitters.
Yep. And for each one, we'll explore its cultural footprint, the biological mechanisms that make it unique, how it could revolutionize modern commercial farming, and specifically, whether it makes practical sense for you, the small farmer or backyard grower, to try cultivating it.
Let's jump right in, and we should begin with a plant that utterly defies botanical expectations right out of the gate. We're going to start with a crop called ajipa.
Ah, ajipa.
Yeah, botanically, it's classified as Bachyrhiziaceous ajipa. And what is fundamentally wild about ajipa is that it's a member of the legume family.
Wait, like peas and beans.
Exactly like peas and beans. Now, when we typically talk about legumes in a backyard setting, we're talking about vining plants grown for their edible seeds or pods, right?
Right.
But ajipa redirects an enormous amount of its biological energy underground to produce this massive, fleshy, 1 kilogram tuberous root.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately because the cultural use of this is fascinating. Unlike the vast majority of root crops like potatoes or yams, which require heavy cooking, ajipa is eaten completely raw.
Yeah, you just eat it raw.
Culturally, the Andean people use it almost like a fruit. You know, as a refreshing summer snack. The texture is incredibly crisp, sweet, and apple-like.
And it stays crunchy, right?
Yeah, you can slice it directly into salads. And what's amazing from a culinary perspective is it has this cellular structure that never loses its crunch.
Yeah.
Even if you boil it or toss it into a high-heat stir-fry, it retains that crispness, like a water chestnut.
That's so unique for a root.
But as an anthropologist, what I find most compelling is how it fits into the broader ecological strategy. They were farming on steep, rocky, nutrient-poor slopes. So how did they sustain soil fertility without chemical fertilizers?
Well, that brings us exactly to the agricultural transformation this plant offers. The answer is nitrogen fixation.
Ah, of course.
Yeah, and it's crucial to understand how this mechanism actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Because ajipa is a legume, it has evolved a highly sophisticated symbiotic relationship with a specific genus of soil bacteria called rhizobium. These bacteria literally infect the root hairs of the ajipa plant, but it's a mutually beneficial infection. The plant forms these little tumors or nodules to house them.
Wow, like little bacterial hotels.
Exactly. And the bacteria have an enzyme called nitrogenase. This allows them to take inert nitrogen gas directly out of the atmospheric air, which plants normally cannot use, and convert it into bioavailable ammonia.
That is just wild.
And in exchange, the plant pumps the sugars it creates through photosynthesis down into the roots to feed the bacteria. The result? AHIPA literally fertilizes its own soil while it grows.
That sounds like an absolute holy grail for a small regenerative farmer. But I have to push back here, because as I was reading through the source material on AHIPA, I hit a massive red flag.
Uh-oh. I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, it's not all sunshine, nitrogen, and crunchy salads. There is a serious toxicity issue with this plant that we absolutely must address if we're going to talk about people planting this in their backyards.
You are entirely correct, and it is a vital distinction to make. While the tuberous root is delicious and completely safe, the rest of the plant is unequivocally toxic.
The leaves, the stems, all of it.
All of it. The leaves, the stems, the pods, and crucially the seeds, contain a potent, naturally occurring chemical compound called rotenone.
And that's an insecticide, right?
A powerful, broad-spectrum insecticide and a piscicide, meaning it kills fish. In fact, indigenous populations in the Amazon historically crushed plants containing rotenone and threw them into rivers to suffocate fish for easy harvesting.
Wow.
Yeah, it acts by interfering with the electron transport chain in mitochondria, effectively stopping cellular respiration. So you absolutely cannot, under any circumstances, eat the beans that this legume produces.
So given that chemical landmine, let me challenge you on the backyard grower advice. If a listener has kids or dogs that like to chew on random foliage, should they really be cultivating this?
It's a very fair challenge. If you have grazing pets or very young children who eat ornamental garden plants, I would definitely advise caution.
Just to be safe.
Right. But it's just like I would with rhubarb, where the stalks are edible, but the leaves contain toxic levels of oxalic acid. Or tomatoes, where the fruit is fine, but the foliage has toxic alkaloids.
Oh, that's a great point. We already grow toxic stuff.
Exactly. So if you're a mindful grower, the feasibility of AHIPA is actually highly recommended.
But why AHIPA over Jicama, though? Because Jicama is already available in the grocery store. I mean, they seem really similar.
They are related, but it comes down to its growth habit and its photoperiodism. Jicama is an aggressive, sprawling, climbing vine that can completely take over a trellis system.
Oh, I see.
And more importantly, Jicama is highly day-length sensitive. It requires the specific short 12-hour equatorial days of autumn to trigger the hormonal shift required to form its roots.
So it wouldn't work up north.
Right. If you plant Jicama in the northern United States, it will just grow miles of toxic vine and never produce a root before the frost kills it. But AHIPA is a small, compact, non-climbing bush. It matures incredibly fast.
And it's day-length neutral.
Crucially, yes. It's day-length neutral. It can happily form massive roots during the long 14-hour summer days of North America or Europe.
The tricky part, I imagine, is just getting your hands on it. The seed sources are incredibly rare.
Yeah, mostly locked up in international germplasm banks in Copenhagen or tucked away in remote Andean valleys.
But if a listener can acquire it, it represents a perfect, low-maintenance, soil-building crop for temperate backyard gardens.
Exactly. Now, AHIPA is a root you want to eat crisp and raw. But the Incas didn't just survive on raw snacks. They needed dense, cooked calories.
Very true.
So the next plant on our journey represents a masterclass in flavor and caloric density.
Yes, let's talk about Uracacha, botanically known as Aracacia xanthoriza. If AHIPA is the raw, refreshing apple of the underground, Uracacha is the ultimate savory, cooked comfort food.
And botanically, it is entirely unrelated to potatoes or legumes.
Right.
Uracacha is an umbellifer. That's the botanical family characterized by their umbrella-like flower clusters. Mm. Above ground, this plant looks incredibly similar to standard garden celery.
Okay, so thick stalks and stuff.
Yeah, thick ribbed stalks and heavily lobed green leaves. But below ground, it produces these cluster formations of smooth-skinned, fleshy roots that resemble swollen white, yellow, or even purple carrots.
The culinary profile of this root is just a masterpiece of complex flavors. When you cook it, it does not taste like a potato or a carrot.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like a bizarre but incredibly delicious amalgamation of celery, roasted cabbage, and sweet roasted chestnuts.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
In Colombia, this plant isn't a lost crop at all. It's a cultural cornerstone. You literally cannot make their traditional sancocho stews without it. It provides the thick, hearty base and the signature flavor profile of the dish.
I love that they practice total crop utilization, too.
Yes. The celery-like stems above ground are chopped up and eaten as a vegetable while the roots are boiled into the stews. And in Brazil, they've recently recognized the commercial appeal of this unique flavor.
What are they doing with it?
They've started processing it into dried chips for use in mass-market instant commercial soups.
That makes so much sense. And if we look closely at the biological mechanisms of arracacha, it reveals why it is such a critical food source.
Let's hear it.
Well, yes, it is incredibly rich in calcium and vitamin A, especially the yellow varieties.
Mm.
But its real superpower, the trait that could revolutionize specific sectors of global health and agriculture, lies in the microscopic structure of its starch.
Okay, here we go.
The starch granules in arracacha are exceptionally tiny.
So why does the physical size of a starch granule matter when we eat it?
It all comes down to the mechanics of human digestion. When you eat a complex carbohydrate, the digestive enzymes in your gut, primarily amylase, have to attach to the surface of the starch granules to break them down into absorbable simple sugars.
Right, surface area.
Exactly. A potato has relatively large starch granules, meaning less surface area relative to its volume, making it slower and harder to digest. Arracacha's microscopic starch granules offer massive surface area.
So they break down faster.
They are so small that they are broken down and digested almost instantly by the human body with zero gastrointestinal stress.
Oh, wow.
This makes it an absolute biological goldmine as a potential cash crop for manufacturing baby food where infant digestive tracts are still developing. Or for hospital patients suffering from severe GI illnesses who need high-caloric, instantly bioavailable energy.
But again, if it is so perfect, why isn't it growing on every farm in North America? I mean, the Incas cultivated this in very specific environments, so bringing it out of the Andes must pose some serious horticultural hurdle.
Oh, it really does. The primary hurdle is time. Arracacha is a painfully slow grower.
How slow.
It can take up to 400 days to fully mature and size up its roots. Think about that from an agricultural perspective. That is more than a full year in the ground.
Yikes. That's a huge commitment.
You're tying up valuable field space for over a year for a single harvest. You could cycle through three successions of radishes, lettuce, or even fast potatoes in that same window.
Plus, in agricultural trials conducted by researchers outside its native range, like in Puerto Rico, it's proven highly susceptible to modern pests.
Yeah, it gets hammered.
It's been plagued by spider mites attacking the celery-like foliage, microscopic nematodes destroying the roots, and severe fungal root rots when the soil gets too wet.
Exactly. So if a backyard grower in Ohio, London, or Toronto is listening to this and wants to grow the ultimate digestible baby food, this is going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
Ah, that's a bummer.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. Arracacha is highly day-length sensitive, requiring precise lighting cues, and it is entirely, utterly intolerant of even a mild frost. A single freeze will turn the plant to mush.
So no cold climates at all.
It is best suited exclusively for growers in subtropical or highly protected tropical zones. If you live in South Florida, Hawaii, or Puerto Rico, you have a much better chance.
And you can actually find propagating offsets down there.
Yeah, the little corm-like structures at the base of the stem are sold in local agricultural markets there. Mm. Brazil is the perfect example.
Right, because of their climate.
What's fascinating here is how Brazil recognized the starch potential, took this ancient, largely ignored Inca crop, and because they have the perfect warm, frost-free climate, they turned it into a massive 10,000-hectare modern agricultural industry.
It perfectly illustrates that these lost crops aren't inherently flawed or inferior to European crops. They just require a profound respect for their specific environmental adaptations.
That is so true.
Which leads us beautifully to a crop that thrives where absolutely nothing else can. I mean, we just talked about arracacha needing subtropical warmth and coddling over 400 days.
Yeah, quite the diva.
But what did the Incas grow in the death zones of the empire? What did they plant where the air is freezing, the soil is basically pulverized barren rock, and the high-altitude UV radiation is absolutely blinding?
They grew maca, botanically Lepidium myeni.
Maca, I've heard of that.
You probably have.
Yeah.
This plant is a member of the cruciferae family. That makes it a high-altitude cousin of the radish, the cabbage, and the mustard plant. But it grows in the Puna region of the Peruvian Andes, specifically between 3,800 and 4,300 meters in elevation.
Goodness.
That is over 13,000 feet above sea level. There are very, very few places on the entire planet where human agriculture exists at that altitude. The oxygen is incredibly thin, the wind is relentless, and the temperatures are brutal.
The ethnobotanical history of maca is just one of the most fascinating stories in the entire Inca ledger.
It really is.
Visually, it looks like a somewhat unremarkable shriveled brown or yellow radish. But when you harvest it and dry it in the sun, this chemical transformation occurs, and it develops this incredibly rich, sweet, tangy, butterscotch-like flavor.
Butterscotch radish. Who would have thought?
Right. The traditional preparation involves boiling the dried roots in water or milk, and it produces a beverage that the Andean people swear is sweeter and more complex than cocoa.
That sounds delicious.
But its real fame, stretching back centuries before the Spanish arrived, is its deeply ingrained cultural reputation as a powerful aphrodisiac and fertility enhancer.
Ah, yes. The famous maca marketing.
And this wasn't just local folklore. It literally altered colonial history. When the Spanish conquistadors tried to move their prized Andalusian horses and livestock up into the Andean highlands, the animals began dying of altitude sickness.
And they stopped breeding, right?
Exactly. The ones that survived completely stopped reproducing. The local indigenous farmers, seeing the Spanish panic, told them to feed their starving animals maca.
And it worked.
It worked so spectacularly well that the Spanish crown actually altered their taxation laws, demanding that local indigenous taxes be paid in tons of maca instead of gold or silver.
Wow. It is a phenomenal historical anecdote, but as a scientist, I have to firmly push back on the romantic, modern marketing mythology that paints maca as some sort of miracle aphrodisiac.
Yeah, I figured you might.
We see maca powder sold in health food stores today for $50 a bag, promising to instantly cure infertility. But we need to ask the biological question here.
Which
is maca truly enhancing fertility through some unique, undiscovered steroidal or hormonal mechanism? Or is it simply providing a massive, highly bioavailable blast of essential calories, protein, iron, and iodine to an otherwise starving highland population?
Oh, so you're saying it is essentially a high-altitude multivitamin rather than a magic potion?
Precisely. Consider the physiological context. At 14,000 feet, mammals, both human and livestock, are highly stressed by hypoxia, cold, and severe malnutrition.
That makes sense. Their bodies are just trying to survive.
Exactly. In a state of chronic caloric and mineral deficiency, the mammalian body shuts down non-essential functions, primarily the reproductive endocrine system, to conserve energy for basic survival.
And then they eat maca.
Right. Now introduce a root that is packed with 13 to 16% protein, which is astronomically high for a root crop, along with dense carbohydrates, iron to build red blood cells, and iodine to regulate the thyroid.
The body suddenly has the building blocks it desperately needs.
It drastically improves overall health, which naturally and rapidly restores reproductive function. It is a nutritional rescue mechanism, not necessarily a hormonal magic trick.
I have to admit, that lecanistic explanation makes total sense. It strips away the mysticism, but actually makes the plant more impressive.
Right. It's just beautifully adapted.
It's extreme nutritional density engineered for the exact environment where it's needed most. But you mentioned earlier that despite its toughness, maca is actually in trouble as an agricultural crop.
Yes, unfortunately.
Oh, huh.
Its survival mechanisms are incredible. I mean, it survives daily temperature swings from balmy and intensely sunny during the day to well below freezing every single night.
How does it even do that?
The plant literally hugs the ground in a tight rosette to avoid the wind and trap thermal heat from the soil.
Oh.
However, as an agricultural crop, it has faced severe decline. It was actually formally declared an endangered cultivated species in 1982.
How does a plant that can survive 14,000-foot freezing winds become endangered?
Because of the human element. The traditional husbandry required to cultivate maca is incredibly, almost punishingly labor-intensive.
What's the process?
To produce viable seed, Andean farmers have to carefully dig up the best, healthiest roots, manually transplant them into walled sheep corrals, heavily fertilize them with sheep manure, and wait for them to flower and go to seed.
That sounds exhausting.
It gets worse. The planting process itself is grueling. They don't have tractors. They scatter the tiny seeds over the rock, hard, freezing ground, and then literally herd flocks of sheep back and forth over the field to trample the seeds into the earth so they don't blow away.
Oh my gosh, that is backbreaking work in a hostile climate.
Exactly. And as cheaper, easily prepared, highly processed foods like refined flour and rice are imported up into the highlands via modern roads, the younger indigenous generations are understandably abandoning the grueling cultivation of maca.
We urgently need genetic preservation programs to save these land races before the indigenous farmers who know how to grow them pass away.
Absolutely. So, Translating this to the modern listener wanting to grow maca in their backyard, the feasibility is exceptionally poor.
Yeah, I was going to say, my backyard does not have a sheep corral.
You are dealing with a plant adapted to a completely bizarre, paradoxical microclimate. Freezing cold nights, but intense, unfiltered, equatorial, high-altitude sun during the day.
Unless you happen to live in the high Himalayas or the alpine peaks of the Rockies, it will likely just rot or bolt in a standard garden.
Plus, obtaining viable seed is difficult, as it's largely restricted to local Andean germplasm banks. This is a crop that humanity needs to save on a global institutional level, but it is not a practical project for a suburban raised bed.
Precisely. We need to save the genetics, but you shouldn't try to grow it in New Jersey. That's... Now, since maca is so incredibly finicky and labor-intensive to cultivate, let's contrast it by looking at a neighboring high-altitude crop that is almost impossible to kill. Let's examine Moshua.
Yes, Moshua, scientifically known as Tropiolum tuberosum. This is a botanical relative of the beautiful flowering garden nasturtium that many people grow in their trellises.
But culturally, Moshua holds a completely inverted reputation compared to maca.
Oh, completely inverted.
While maca is the highly prized, expensive, sweet-tasting fertility booster, Moshua has historically been heavily stigmatized. It's often shunned as a poor person's crop, eaten only when the potato harvests fail.
And there's the whole anti-aphrodisiac thing.
Exactly. Completely opposite to maca, Moshua is considered a potent anti-aphrodisiac. In deeply traditional Andean culture, adult men will flat out refuse to eat it.
Really? They won't touch it?
They leave it entirely for the women and children, harboring a deeply ingrained belief that consuming Moshua lowers male virility and causes impotence.
That is wild.
And from a culinary standpoint, it is also polarizing. When you pull it out of the ground and bite into it raw, it is violently peppery, much like a shockingly strong radish or raw horseradish.
But then you cook it.
Yeah, through the alchemy of heat, when you boil or roast it, the heat destroys those volatile compounds, and it completely transforms, becoming soft and surprisingly sweet.
What is truly fascinating here is the underlying biochemistry that explains both that violent peppery taste and the anti-aphrodisiac folklore.
Okay, let's unpack this biochemistry.
Moshua contains extremely high concentrations of a class of compounds called glucosinolates, specifically yielding mustard oils. These are the exact same defensive chemicals that give horseradish, wasabi, and strong mustards their aggressive kick.
So it's basically loaded with wasabi oil.
Pretty much. But these aren't just flavor compounds. They are highly evolved, incredibly potent natural pesticides.
Oh, wow.
When an insect or microscopic nematode bites into the Moshua root, it crushes the plant cells. This crushing action mixes the glucosinolates with an enzyme called myrosinase, which is kept in a separate cellular compartment.
Like a binary explosive.
Exactly. The mixture instantly detonates a microscopic chemical weapon, literally a mustard oil bomb, right in the pest's mouth.
That is brilliant biological warfare. So this plant essentially has a built-in systemic defense grid.
Exactly. And this makes Moshua an absolute dream crop for modern organic farmers. You naturally repel soil-borne insects, devastating root knot nematodes, and various bacterial rots.
So you don't really have to do much to it.
You can plant Moshua in poor marginal soil, give it absolutely zero care, weed it rarely, and it will aggressively outcompete weeds and yield an astonishing 30 to 50 tons per hectare.
That's insane tonnage. But what about the anti-aphrodisiac properties? Is there any truth to that?
Well, while it hasn't been definitively proven in human clinical trials, high chronic dietary consumption of certain glucosinolates can interfere with iodine uptake.
Which affects the thyroid.
Right, potentially leading to mild hypothyroidism, which in turn can suppress testosterone and libido. So the Andean men's folklore may actually be rooted in observable biochemical reality.
So what does this all mean? The ethnobotanical implications of this are staggering. It means the Incas had a profound understanding of organic pesticide systems centuries before the invention of synthetic agrochemicals.
They were way ahead of their time.
They utilized a highly sophisticated intercropping system. They would deliberately plant rows of Moshua directly interspersed with their vulnerable potato crops.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah. They were engineering a companion planting system based on the invisible chemical defenses of this specific tuber, utilizing the volatile mustard oils of the Moshua to create an invisible shield over the potatoes.
It is a masterclass in agricultural ecology. However, modern attempts to scale up this agricultural transformation face a significant invisible hurdle.
Always a hurdle.
Because Moshua does not readily produce seed, it has been vegetatively propagated, meaning grown from clone tubers for literally millennia.
And what's the issue with cloning it that long?
When you clone a plant continuously for 10,000 years, it accumulates a massive viral load. Every virus the parent plant catches is passed directly to the offspring.
Ah, so it just gets sicker and sicker.
These ancient viral infections don't usually kill the Mashua plant. It's way too tough for that. But they act as a chronic drag on its metabolism, suppressing its true yield potential.
So how do we fix a 10,000-year-old viral infection?
We use a modern laboratory technique called tissue culture cleansing. You take a microscopic slice from the very tip of the plant's actively growing shoot, called the apical meristem.
Okay, the very tip.
Right. The cells in the meristem are dividing and pushing upward faster than the virus can travel through the plant's vascular system.
Oh, that is so cool.
So if you carefully slice off just that microscopic virus-free tip under sterile laboratory conditions and grow it in a nutrient agar, you can regenerate an entirely new, completely virus-free plant.
We need to establish these clean planting stocks, clearly.
Furthermore, breeders need to select for day-length adaptation, as many of the traditional, wildly colorful Andean strains will simply refuse to form tubers under the long summer days of the Northern Hemisphere.
But despite those challenges, for the backyard organic grower listening, the advice from Mashua is overwhelmingly positive, right?
Highly positive. It offers excellent feasibility, specifically for organic pest control.
That's great news.
If you can source day-length neutral strains, and thankfully, dedicated breeders have already established thriving day-length neutral populations in places like New Zealand and the Pacific Northwest of the United States,
yeah,
you can implement the exact same ink and intercropping strategy.
So just stick it next to your regular crops.
Yeah, Mashua thrives in cool, damp, temperate climates. You can plant it among your potatoes, carrots, or beets, harvest a huge yield of beautiful tubers, and let its root exudates do the subterranean pest control work for your entire garden bed.
That is an incredibly actionable takeaway.
Yeah.
So let's move from a crop that is ubiquitous and fiercely defensive to a crop that was so thoroughly, profoundly lost that modern Western science did not even know it existed until the 1960s.
It still blows my mind.
Let's explore Manosa.
It sounds impossible in the modern era to just discover a root crop, but it is true. Mauca, botanically named Mirobilis expansa, is part of the Nyctaginaceae, or 4 o'clock plant family, known for their vibrant, late-blooming flowers.
Okay.
It produces thick, aggressive stems and dense, fleshy, swollen roots. It was completely unknown to the outside botanical world until a scientist happened to stumble upon it growing in a remote, high-altitude valley in Bolivia in the 1960s.
As an anthropologist, the story of Mauca is where the intersection of botany and human history gets absolutely riveting.
The whole geography of it is weird.
Yes. When scientists finally began mapping where Mauca was being cultivated, they realized it was only found in 3 tiny, highly isolated, high-altitude pockets in the entire Andes mountain range.
Like hundreds of miles apart.
Exactly. One enclave in Bolivia, one in Ecuador, and one in Peru. These pockets are separated by hundreds of kilometers of impassable terrain.
So how did it get there?
That's the biological question, right? How did a flightless, heavily domesticated root crop jump hundreds of miles across the Andes in 3 distinct leaps? The answer lies in a fascinating ethnological theory.
Tell me.
The Inca Empire maintained a draconian, highly effective geopolitical policy called mitme. When a specific regional tribe became rebellious or refused to assimilate, the Inca military would step in, forcibly uproot the entire population, and relocate them to opposite, fragmented ends of the empire to break up their centralized power.
That is brutal.
It was. And the scattered, isolated geographic locations of Mauca cultivation aligned perfectly with the historical archaeological records of the Incas forcibly relocating specific rebellious tribes.
So they took the plant with them.
When these people were marched hundreds of miles into exile, they secretly took their most precious, hardy survival food with them. Mauca is quite literally a living botanical artifact of an ancient, brutal political strategy.
And you can clearly understand why they chose to carry it into exile. It's an extraordinary survival food.
It's super nutritious, right?
Motika is an absolute powerhouse of dense nutrition. It boasts an astonishing 7% protein content, which is exponentially higher than a standard potato, and it is exceptionally high in calcium.
And it handles the weather well.
Furthermore, from an agronomic standpoint, the above-ground foliage is incredibly robust. It survives the brutal, constant desiccating winds of the high Andes that would physically snap or entirely dehydrate standard potato plants.
But actually eating it requires some ancient specific knowledge, right? Because if you just pull it out of the ground and take a bite, it is a deeply unpleasant experience.
Oh, yeah. Preparing it is botanically tricky. Fresh out of the earth, Montica is highly astringent.
Where it burns.
It contains harsh chemical compounds that will literally burn and pucker the mucous membranes in your mouth. But the indigenous people, through centuries of empirical observation, discovered the mechanism to neutralize this.
How do they do it?
If you leave the harvested roots exposed to the harsh, high-altitude UV sunlight and freezing night temperatures for several days, a profound chemical change occurs within the cellular structure.
So the sun cures it.
The plant's internal enzymes are triggered, breaking down the astringent compounds and converting the complex starches into simple sugars. It transforms from a burning, inedible root into something incredibly sweet, with a texture and flavor profile rivaling a rich sweet potato.
See, this perfectly highlights a critical gap in our modern knowledge. We have this high-protein, wind-resistant superfood, but it remains almost completely unstudied by modern agronomy.
We really don't know much about it.
We simply don't know the mechanical details. We don't fully understand its day-length requirements for tuberization. We don't know its precise drought tolerance or water needs.
We don't even know the exact chemical name of the compound that causes that initial astringency.
Right, nor have we mapped the specific enzymatic pathway that converts those compounds to sugar under UV light. We are completely in the dark.
Which means for the listener at home, the backyard grower eager to try something new, Macuca is strictly highly experimental.
If they can even find it.
Exactly. It is profoundly difficult to find viable seed or propagating offsets outside of those specific remote Bolivian and Ecuadorian villages, or a handful of university research greenhouses.
Yeah, it's a shame.
This raises an important question, though, for global agriculture. How many other highly nutritious, resilient superfoods are currently hiding in isolated mountain valleys, guarded by a few elderly indigenous farmers, just waiting to be discovered by the wider world before they go extinct?
It honestly gives you chills thinking about what else is out there silently growing in a forgotten valley.
It really does.
But let's shift our focus from the most forgotten, isolated tuber to the absolute runner-up king of the Andes. We are moving to a crop that is second in importance only to the mighty potato itself. Let's talk about urca.
Oxalis tuberosa. If mauca is the hidden survivor, urca is the vibrant, ubiquitous superstar.
It looks so cool.
Visually, urca is stunning. The tubers look somewhat like stubby, deeply wrinkled, knobby carrots, but they come in an explosion of brilliant, almost fluorescent colors. Neon pinks, bright yellows, deep reds, and pure whites.
The culinary versatility of urca is incredible, largely driven by its unique chemical profile. The taste spectrum ranges from very sweet, I mean, so naturally high in sugar that certain varieties are actually sold as fresh fruits in local Peruvian markets, mm-hmm. to sharply, intensely acidic.
And that acidity is oxalic acid, right?
Yes, the same compound that gives rhubarb its tartness. In fact, many culinary fans and chefs who have discovered urca call them potatoes that don't need sour cream.
That's such a great description.
Because that tangy, rich, acidic flavor is already baked right into the cellular matrix of the tuber. You just roast it, and the flavor profile is already perfectly balanced.
And it's popular outside the Andes, too, right?
Culturally, it has successfully broken out of the Andes. It is hugely popular in high-altitude regions of Mexico, where it was introduced centuries ago by the Spanish galleon trade.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And fascinatingly, it has become a major commercial crop in New Zealand, where they rebranded it and market it nationally as the New Zealand yam, serving it traditionally roasted alongside their famous lamb dishes.
That is fascinating. Agronomically, urca is a phenomenal workhorse. In the harsh, marginal, impoverished climates of the high Andes, where soil fertility is low and temperatures fluctuate wildly, urca can consistently yield up to twice as much caloric mass per hectare as the potato.
Wow, twice as much.
It is the reliable engine of the high-altitude diet. But, much like Mashua, it is a clonally propagated tuber, which means it suffers from a 10,000-year buildup of debilitating viral infections that suppress its maximum yield.
So it needs that tissue culture cleansing, too.
Yes, and the photoperiodism issue is severe. While the strains grown commercially in New Zealand have been painstakingly selected over decades to be day-length neutral, the vast majority of the raw, intensely colorful Andean strains will stubbornly refuse to form tubers during the long 14-hour summer days of North America or Europe.
So what happens if you plant it anyway?
If you plant a raw Andean tuber in your Chicago garden, it will grow a massive, beautiful bush of clover-like foliage, but when the frost hits in October, you will dig it up and find absolutely nothing but thin, stringy roots.
Oh, man, that would be so disappointing. So, translating that into actionable advice for the backyard grower, the feasibility is fantastic, but only if you acquire the precise adapted genetics.
Exactly. Do not just buy an oca tuber from a Peruvian grocery importer and plant it in June.
Good tip.
You need to look specifically in specialty seed catalogs for propagating tubers labeled as New Zealand yam, or explicitly noted as being bred for northern latitudes and day length neutrality.
If you get the right one.
If you secure the right strain, it does exceedingly well in temperate, cool climates like the Pacific Northwest or the UK. However, a major warning here. Do not attempt to grow this in hot, highly humid lowlands like the American South.
Why? What happens?
The plant structure is fleshy and soft. In a sweltering, humid summer, the stems will literally melt into a pile of bacterial rot. It needs cool roots and temperate air.
Okay, let's unpack this next one carefully, because at first glance, it sounds like we are retreating to familiar territory. We are talking about potatoes.
The humble potato.
But we just stated that Aka is second to the potato. Why are we dedicating time to the potato in a deep dive specifically focused on lost and forgotten crops?
Because the singular potato you buy in a 5-pound bag at the modern grocery store, Solanum tuberosum, is just one incredibly narrow genetic sliver of what the Incas cultivated.
Right.
The Andes mountain range is the evolutionary birthplace of the potato, and the indigenous people cultivated several distinct, wildly different species of potato that modern agriculture has completely ignored. Today we're focusing on one of these lost cousins, a highly specialized species known as Solanum ajonjuri.
The cultural application of this specific potato species is a masterclass in risk management. The Aymara Indians, who live in the highest, most brutally cold sectors of the Altiplano, do not grow ajonjuri for its culinary delicacy.
It's an insurance crop.
They cultivate it strictly as a living insurance policy. In a normal year, they eat standard, better-tasting potatoes. But when the dreaded severe frosts sweep down the mountains and completely annihilate the standard potato crops, causing widespread famine, the ajonjuri survives.
And the trade-off is the taste.
Exactly. The biological trade-off for this extreme survival mechanism is flavor. The ajonjuri is packed with high levels of glycoalkaloids, defensive compounds that make it intensely bitter and mildly toxic if eaten fresh.
So they have to process it.
So the Aymara utilize a genius thermodynamic processing method to create a product called chuno. They take these bitter frozen potatoes and spread them out on the freezing ground at night.
To let the ice do the work.
Right. The internal water freezes into jagged ice crystals, physically puncturing the plant's cell walls. The next day, the intense high-altitude sun hits them, and the ice sublimates, turning directly from a solid into a gas.
That is just amazing physics.
Then the people literally stomp on the dehydrated potatoes with their bare feet. This stomping physically acts like wringing out a cellular sponge, squeezing all the bitter, toxic glycoalkaloid liquid out of the ruptured cells.
And then they can store it forever.
After a few cycles of freezing, sun-drying, and stomping, they are left with a pure, chalky carbohydrate skeleton that can be stored safely in stone bins for literally decades without rotting.
The physics and chemistry of that indigenous processing are astounding. But what's equally fascinating is the extreme genetics of the ajonjuri plant itself.
How cold can it get?
This potato species can survive black frosts down to -5 degrees Celsius. That is 23 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's crazy for a leafy plant.
If a standard commercial russet potato is exposed to a mild frost of 31 degrees, the water inside its cells freezes, expands, and shatters the cellular structure, turning the plant into a rotting black mush by noon.
But the ajonjuri doesn't.
Right, it somehow manages its cellular solutes, perhaps by pumping sugars or specific antifreeze proteins into its cell walls to prevent ice crystallization at deeply sub-zero temperatures.
Meteor's antifreeze.
Furthermore, it has evolved high immunity to severe, globally devastating potato diseases like blackwort fungus and cyst nematodes. It produces tubers with exceptionally high dry matter content, perfect for processing, and is densely packed with vitamin C.
But despite possessing traits that modern breeders would kill for, it is currently facing imminent extinction in its native range.
Yes, and the irony is tragic. It is being phased out by well-meaning but short-sighted modern agricultural programs that push heavily bred, commercial, high-yield Solanum tuberosum varieties onto indigenous farmers.
Because they yield faster.
These commercial varieties yield bigger, prettier potatoes faster in good years, allowing farmers to sell them for cash. Consequently, the farmers are abandoning their ancient, bitter insurance crop for immediate economic gain.
But then a bad frost hits.
Exactly. When the inevitable severe frost year hits, the commercial crops die, and the insurance crop is no longer in the ground. If the unique, frost-resistant genes of John Weary aren't comprehensively collected and saved in global germplasm banks immediately, they will be gone forever.
So, can a backyard grower in a cold climate buy some of these frost-proof potatoes to plant in late autumn?
Currently, it is virtually impossible to acquire outside of highly restricted academic breeding programs or international seed banks.
Oh, man.
However, it represents the ultimate genetic goldmine for the future of global food security. If geneticists and plant breeders can map and unlock these specific frost-resistant gene sequences and hybridize them into our common palatable potatoes, it would completely rewrite agricultural maps.
That would be revolutionary.
Backyard growers and commercial farmers in freezing northern climates from Canada to Scandinavia to the steppes of Russia could suddenly grow highly productive potato crops late into the freezing winter, entirely avoiding the hungry gap of early spring.
It is a breathtaking potential.
Yeah.
All right, let's pivot from the earthy, bitter, survivalist brown potatoes and imagine walking into a bustling, modern Andean agricultural market.
Oh, this is a fun one.
We are looking for a tuber that doesn't look like it belongs in the dirt. It looks like it belongs in a high-end candy store. Let's talk about Uluko.
Ulucus tuberosus. If we thought oka was colorful, Uluko is practically neon.
Yeah, it looks fake almost.
The tubers are small, perfectly smooth, and come in mind-bendingly bright shades of canary yellow, hot pink, deep crimson, and even brilliant candy stripe patterns. They're so smooth and naturally shiny that when you wash the dirt off, they literally look like they are molded out of brightly colored wax or polished plastic.
Culturally, Uluko holds a very privileged position in modern Andean society. It has entirely escaped the stigma of being a poverty food or a famine crop, a stigma that unfortunately holds back incredibly useful crops like mashua.
It's a high-status food.
Uluko is a culinary status symbol. You can walk into upscale, brightly lit, modern supermarkets in major capital cities like Lima, Peru, or Quito, Ecuador, and you will find Uluko washed, sorted by color, and sold in premium plastic packaging at a high price point.
And it's easy to cook.
The culinary draw, aside from the beautiful color, is the preparation. The skin of the Uluko tuber is so incredibly thin and delicate that it requires absolutely no peeling. You just wash them and throw them directly into the pot.
And its real botanical superpower, the reason it commands such a high price, is its unique cellular texture. Most traditional starchy root crops like standard potatoes, cassava, or sweet potatoes are high in amylose starches.
Right, they get mushy.
Exactly. When you boil them in liquid for an extended period, the cellular matrix breaks down, the starches gelatinize, and the tuber turns to a soft mush or disintegrates entirely to thicken the broth. Uluko defies this entirely.
How so?
It has a highly dense pectin structure in its cell walls. Even when you subject it to high heat and boil it into a thick, hot, traditional stew for an hour, the tuber refuses to break down. It remains completely intact and crisply crunchy.
So it's like a hot water chestnut in a stew.
Exactly. That highly unusual textural contrast, a hot, savory stew containing bright, crunchy tubers, is highly prized in Andean gastronomy.
But as with all these highly specialized indigenous crops, attempting to scale it up or move it out of the Andes presents serious challenges.
Absolutely. As with our other clonally propagated tubers, mashua and oka, it is highly infected with generations of ancient viruses that depress its yield. But the true limiting factor is its severe photoperiodism.
It's day-length sensitive again.
Violently day-length sensitive. It absolutely requires the very specific short 12-hour days of the equatorial autumn to signal the plant's hormonal system to stop producing foliage and start swelling tubers underground.
Which means the advice for the backyard grower in North America or Europe is highly challenging, bordering on impractical.
Yes. In northern latitudes, it is exceedingly difficult. It needs the combination of short days and cool weather. While the foliage is mildly frost-resistant, if you plant it in the U.S. or Europe in May, the tuber simply will not initiate formation during our long 15-hour summer days.
And by the time the days get short enough?
The ground is frozen. By the time the days finally get short enough in late October or November to trigger tuberization, the ground in temperate zones is likely freezing solid, killing the process before the tubers can size up.
So there's no way to grow it?
Well, the only way a hobbyist can successfully grow Uluko in a northern climate is to use a temperature-controlled greenhouse and employ light deprivation techniques. Literally pulling black tarps over the plants at 5 p.m. every day in late summer to artificially trick the plant into thinking winter is approaching.
Okay, yeah. That's a fun experiment for a dedicated botany nerd, but not a practical food crop for the average gardener.
Fair enough. Let's finish our botanical journey with our ninth crop, a tuber that acts so wildly different from the rest that it defies everything we think we know about starchy, heavy root vegetables.
Yes, let's look at yucca.
Polymnia sanctifolia. Unlike almost everything else we've discussed today, the legumes, the umbellifers, the brassicas, the nightshades, yucca is a member of the Asteraceae family.
Like sunflowers.
Exactly, making it a distant botanical relative of the sunflower, the dahlia, and the Jerusalem artichoke. It produces massive, towering green foliage and huge clusters of tubers that resemble dark, elongated sweet potatoes.
Here's where it gets really interesting from a culinary and cultural perspective. You do not cook yucca. It is eaten entirely raw.
Completely raw.
When you peel the thin, dark skin, the flesh inside is translucent and incredibly juicy. It is an absolute thirst-quenching refreshment. When you bite into a fresh yucca tuber, the texture and flavor profile is shocking. It is like a cross between a crisp Fuji apple and a sweet watermelon.
It's so hydrating.
The local indigenous people, who are often working hard in the dry, dusty fields under intense sun, dig up yucca specifically to eat it right there in the field to quench their thirst and get a hit of energy. And it's an incredibly efficient plant. The massive, thick main stem is completely edible as well, traditionally peeled and used much like celery in salads or cooked dishes.
The potential agricultural and dietary transformation that yucca offers the modern world is absolutely staggering. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly sweet and aggressively juicy, but it is almost completely calorie-free to the human digestive system.
Wait. How can a large, sweet, carbohydrate-dense root crop have no calories? That sounds biologically impossible.
It comes down to the specific biochemistry of the sugars it produces. Most root crops store energy as complex starches, which our bodies easily break down into glucose.
Right.
Yucca, however, stores its carbohydrates in the form of fructooligosaccharides, commonly referred to as FOS. The chemical bonds holding these specific sugar molecules together are beta 2-1 bonds.
Okay. Getting into the chemistry.
The human digestive tract simply does not produce the specific enzyme inulinase required to break those specific bonds apart. Because we can't break the bonds, we cannot absorb the sugar into our bloodstream.
So it just goes right through us.
It passes completely through the upper digestive system without adding caloric energy or spiking blood sugar or insulin levels. Instead, it travels intact to the large intestine, where it acts as a powerful prebiotic, feeding the beneficial bacteria in your gut microbiome.
That is huge.
Because of this, it represents a massive potential cash crop for the modern diet-conscious demographic and, crucially, for the global diabetic market, offering a completely natural, whole food source of sweetness without the glycemic penalty.
And what about the leaves?
Furthermore, from an agronomic standpoint, the massive amount of towering, high-protein foliage the plant produces above ground shows incredible promise as a high-yield, drought-tolerant fodder crop for feeding livestock.
So a tuber that tastes exactly like a sweet, juicy fruit, acts as a prebiotic, has virtually no digestible calories, and can feed cattle with its leaves. This could completely disrupt both the modern artificial sweetener industry and the livestock feed industry. Are there major breeding challenges holding it back?
It is relatively robust compared to some of the extreme high-altitude crops. The primary challenge is simply selective breeding for wider global adaptability and higher, more consistent tuber yields across varying soil types.
And it sounds pretty manageable.
It is. Finding and isolating the specific landrace strains that thrive best outside the unique day length and temperature fluctuations of the Andes is the current very solvable hurdle for modern agronomists.
And for the backyard grower looking to experiment.
Phenomenal potential. I highly recommend it. It is a fantastic, deeply rewarding backyard novelty. Because it evolved in the more temperate, middle elevation Andean valleys rather than the freezing peaks, it actually prefers moderate, forgiving climates.
So regular gardens could handle it?
If you have a decent long growing season, around 6 to 7 months, and you can locate propagating roots, which, thankfully, are becoming much more commonly available in specialty and organic seed catalogs, is an incredibly fun crop to grow.
That's awesome.
It provides a massive harvest, it's easy to peel, and it is guaranteed to shock anyone who takes a bite expecting a starchy potato, and instead gets a mouthful of sweet watermelon apple juice.
So stepping back, what does this all mean for us today? We have spent the last hour just scratching the absolute surface of an agricultural empire that was nearly systematically erased by colonialism.
We really just scratched the surface.
From the self-fertilizing, nitrogen-generating AHIPA, to the chemical warfare of the pest-proof Meshua, to the insulin-friendly, calorie-free Yakon, these aren't just quaint historical curiosities meant for a museum. They are highly evolved, biological solutions to the most pressing modern agricultural problems.
If we pull back and connect this to the much bigger picture, it becomes glaringly clear that preserving this indigenous biodiversity isn't just an academic exercise in saving history.
No, it's not.
It is a vital, urgent strategy for securing our future global food supply against the accelerating threats of climate change, emerging superpests, and the vulnerability of our heavily monocultured, hyper-reliant modern food system. These plants hold the genetic keys to resilience.
And the incredible thing is, the underground tubers are just the beginning of the story. In our next deep dive into the lost crops of the Incas, we are going to move away from the soil and look upward toward the sun, featuring the lost, highly resilient grains of the Inca Empire, specifically Caniwa, Kiwicha, and the complex history of quinoa.
As we wrap up this exploration, I want to leave you, the listener, with this final provocative thought to ponder. If the Spanish conquistadors, upon arriving in the Andes, had been wise enough to value this staggering agricultural wealth over their insatiable, destructive lust for silver and gold, how many billions of lives over the last 500 years could have been saved from global famine by the froth-proof genetics of the Ajanjuri potato or the impenetrable pest-proof armor of the Mashua?
Thanks for joining us today on Friday Fusions, a supplemental series for Jack Spirko's The Survival Podcast. You can subscribe to this show on all major podcast platforms. Learn more at it at thesurvivalpodcast.com. And remember to keep an eye out each Friday for more Friday Fusion episodes, because you never know what a guy like Jack might come up with for us to cover. And if you have a resource or topic you'd like to hear in a future episode of Friday Fusions, email jack@thesurvivalpodcast with TSPC Fusion in the subject line so that it doesn't get filtered into a spam folder.
Bringing you down. Are they going to bail you out? Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.